volunteers right after we got there. The program, we work for the ELCA, volunteering through them, and they support us financially. And also the Holden Village congregation supported me financially, so I'm glad that they said, please come back and talk about it. So I'm happy for this opportunity. And while we're working there, we actually work for the Evangelical Lutheran Church in Jordan and the Holy Land, which is the Lutheran Church that operates five congregations within East Jerusalem and the West Bank, and one congregation in Amman, Jordan. And the bishop of this church is Bishop Yuneeb Yunan, and he was just recently elected to be the Lutheran World Federation president at the assembly. So that's an interesting tidbit. This picture was taken by the separation wall, which we'll talk about a little bit more. But that's generally about my program. And I was living and working in a small town just outside of Bethlehem called Beit Sahur. And Beit Sahur is one of the only two cities in the West Bank that is majority Christian, which is highly unusual. The Christian population is shrinking in leaps and bounds. About 50 years ago, it was 20% of the population of Palestinians were Christian, and now it's less than 2%. And so having this town being all Christian is kind of an unusual thing. The other town is actually Taipei, just outside of Ramallah, and they are known for their beer making. So. All right, so before I start talking a little bit about the situation, I want to talk about terminology a little bit, because there are a lot of misconceptions in how we say and how we use different definitions for people. When we say Arab is anyone who lives in the Middle East and who comes from Arabian descent, from originating in Saudi Arabia. Arab population is massive. You can be anyone. You're Jordanian, you can be Lebanese, you can be Syrian. There are many people who are Arab. It's just an ethnic definition. Palestinian Arabs means you are a nationality of Palestinian and an Arab coming from that descent. And does not say anything about your religion. You can be a Palestinian Christian Arab, you can be a Palestinian Muslim Arab, you can be a Palestinian Jewish Arab. There are several. So Palestinian Christian is obviously a term for Palestinians who are Christians, and most of them are, their families have been Christian since Jesus. So they've been living in the same spot. Some people come there and ask, well, when did you convert to Christianity? No, we've always been Christian. They're the first Christians. So that's an interesting tidbit. And most of them are Greek Orthodox or Roman Catholic or Syrian Orthodox, mostly Orthodox. The Lutheran population is around 3,000, I think, would be the entire population. So the Protestant is very small. And that's another interesting story how the Protestants came to the Middle East. I'll tell that one later. Palestinian Muslim, obviously, if you're a Muslim, usually you're Arab, and you have Palestinian nationality. Israeli just means you have Israeli citizenship. Israelis do not have to be Jewish. There are many Israeli Arabs who are living still in Israel. They never left after the 1948 war. And they have citizenship in Israel, which is Israeli Arabs. It's the next little thing. Many of them are Muslim. Many of them are Christian. Many of them are Druze, which is a branch of Islam. And many of them are found on the Syrian border or in Haifa in the north. So Israeli Jews is the majority population. However, the Jewish population is not as religious as you might think. They say that about 70% of the population considers themselves secular. Secular Jews, and they consider themselves Jewish by ethnicity, but they don't practice their religion, in an open fashion. They don't go to synagogue, they don't do the kinds of things that you consider faithful with Judaism. Zionist is a term for political ideology. It means that you support the return of Jews to the Holy Land and the creation of the State of Israel. The Zionist movement began in the 1800s in Europe, create a very nice excuse for them to expand their work, and they got support of the UN and many international communities because of that. And so Christian Zionist, for me this is the scariest category, because Christian Zionists support the Zionist movement because they believe that once all the Jews are back in the Holy Land, then the second coming will happen. Jesus will come, and everything that happens in Revelation will start happening, and so then eventually everyone will be killed who is not Christian. And so it's kind of, the Zionists even are a little scared of them because it's like, you want us to come back and then you're going to kill us all? So it's an interesting phenomenon that much research has been done on this, but I don't understand it entirely. All right. Talking about a little bit of political history, the first map was largely under the Ottoman Empire before World War I, and you can see the Jewish communities owned some land. It was about between 5 and 10% of the land, mostly on the coast and in the north. The rest of it was owned by Palestinian farmers, and this is it wasn't a strong state during the Ottoman Empire. It was a loosely organized confederation of different powers and regions and that kind of thing. So that was one of the good excuses we said for the Zionists to come in. They said, well, there's no state there, essentially. It's just a bunch of people living there. And their political propaganda actually said that there was no people there. There's a slogan that says, what is it? A land without a people for a people without a land was the slogan that they used, trying to get Jews to move to the Holy Land. And so that's what it was. That was the general land use. And then after the Zionist movement, there's a lot of stuff that happened with weapons and the Balfour Declaration and all kinds of things that were happening at this point. But eventually, the Zionist forces had enough power to take over the country. And the UN put out this plan that said, well, we'll give the white space to the new Israeli state, and then the Palestinians can have the green space. So you can see the West Bank is considerably larger, there's some space in the north, and then they have Gaza. So it's about 55-45% split. But the Palestinians said, well, why should we give you any of our land? What have we done that we should lose 45% of our land? So they rejected the offer. And some people say this is a large mistake, but you can see their perspective. Why should they give any of this? Like, you can come and live here, but this is our land. I mean, welcome, but you can't kick us out. So they rejected it, and then after the British left, because they've been controlling it under the British mandate since World War I, the British left, and the underground forces, but they've been storing weapons, and then the Israeli army attacked, and they conquered all the borders that you see in the white. In the War of Independence in 1948, that's what the Israelis call it. The Palestinians call it the Nakba, the disaster, the catastrophe. And this was when all the people who were living in this white area were forcibly removed from their homes and became refugees, either in Gaza or the West Bank. Gaza was controlled by Egypt until 1967, and the West Bank was controlled by Jordan. So it was considered Hasmonean-Jordanian empire, part of that. And also East Jerusalem. East Jerusalem was also controlled by Jordan, including the Old City, which is where the Western Wall and some holy spots for the Jewish faith there as well. So there are about 750,000 refugees that created. And since then, they've been living in Gaza and the West Bank since this time, and they've multiplied now to well over 2 million in total. In the West Bank and Gaza, also around the world, there are refugee camps in Lebanon, Syria, and Jordan. They're actually almost far worse off than the ones in the West Bank and Gaza because they are not considered parts of the Lebanese, Syrian, or Jordanian government, so they don't want them there, essentially. And so they keep them in the slums on the edge of the city. But people have been living there since 1948. And this final map is controlled territory now by the Palestinians. Another story for another time. But in the West Bank, you can see, looks a little bit like Swiss cheese. They call it the Swiss cheese model, because after the Oslo Accords in 1994 and 95, they decided that they were going to gradually give back control to the Palestinians. And this happened that the Israelis had control, because in 1967, Israel pushed out its borders. They took over the Sinai, Gaza, and the West Bank, and the Golan Heights. And since that time, the entire area has been occupied. They gave back the Sinai to Egypt. I don't remember exactly what it was in the 70s. But they gave it back to Egypt, and they had created a friendly relationship, so to speak. Stable, at least, for a large degree. But the Gaza and the West Bank have been occupied since that time. So the Oslo Accords were a move to try and give back control to the Palestinians to create a two-state solution. So they wanted an Israeli state and a Palestinian state. So what they did was they created zones. And I will show you in the next slide. They created zones. Area A, B, and C. Area A is considered under complete Palestinian control. They control civil matters and security matters. And that's where you can see the green on the other map.
You can see the green on the other map.
Yeah, these green areas are under Palestinian control. So you can see that the Israelis actually control all the white areas still. So not all the West Bank is under Palestinian control. Area B is under Palestinian civil control, but Israeli security. So they're going to be the ones saying, we need to build a road through here, your house is in the way, we're going to take your house down. They can do that. And Area C is under complete Israeli civil and military control. And they've done this in several ways. Sometimes they make nature reserves that cover vast areas, and they say this is all now under our control. Or the settlement areas are also considered Area C. And so you can see that the area that the Palestinians actually control is considerably less space than the entire West Bank. And the fact that it's carved up, they can't access each part. If you want to drive from Hebron in the south to Jenin in the north, you would have to cross many bits of Area C. And the Israelis are going to control that area through checkpoints. And sometimes they can say, no, you can't come through here. So it's about a 4-hour drive if there was no impediments in the way. But because of the checkpoints and the fact that they have to go through all these Area Cs, it can take 20 hours, 2 days. It can take a long time. And they can be turned around at any point, strip searched, because they might be security threats. Let's see. I don't know what the rest of it is. But then you can see the little blue triangles on the map are settlements. And there are, I think there are about 350,000, if not more, settlers in the West Bank at this point.
You mean Jewish?
Yes, Jewish settlers. And settlements are a massive problem because they're illegal under international law. Because an occupier cannot build structures for its population on occupied land. It's part of the UN's statutes since 1948. So they're illegal, but the Israeli government says that they don't directly support them, even though there are financial channels that have been proven to say that they are supporting them by giving money to American donors, and then they'll send it back again, and it's clean money, kind of. But we'll talk about that a little bit more later. This map on this side is the Nakba, which is the catastrophe, the Palestinian term for it. And all the red village dots show villages that were deserted in 1948. And the green dots show villages that have remained with Palestinians in them. But most of the villages have been razed to the ground, either converted into Israeli towns, or they've been razed to the ground and forced them and planted over them to erase all sign of that there's been anything there. After the 67 war, some Palestinians were allowed to go back and visit their villages that they had abandoned, and there was nothing left. They couldn't, their houses weren't there, that's been also taken over. Okay, so the separation barrier is a new development. It started in the early 2000s. And it's a huge problem, not necessarily because of the fact that there's a barrier, but because of where it goes. It does not follow the green line that was established. Actually, it was established in 1948 as the border between Jordan and Israel. And it's still considered the border of the West Bank and Gaza. However, Israel does not recognize this. Actually, interestingly enough, Israel does not recognize any official borders because they always say that this whole land is theirs and that they can't recognize the borders until they have it all. So you can see the red line is the separation barrier that's going up, and then you can see the green line. And you can see especially up here, you can see the green line is going here, and then the red line goes all the way up here. And so they actually lose about between 10 and 15% of their land. And the problem is that the wall separates the communities, and it separates people from their own land. So there's a city right here, and it's surrounded. The wall came all the way out to go around this city and come back in again. So it's included in the West Bank. It used to be considered Israeli, and people could come out and get jobs in Israel and that kind of thing. And actually, all of their land is right here. But now that there's a wall there, they can't get through and work on their land. So they're essentially cut off. And then there's also a checkpoint here, so they can't get back into the West Bank either, not easily. So their economy, their studies, it's hard to get out of there, into there, it's entirely cut off. And then the issue of Jerusalem is that the wall comes all the way out, all the way into the West Bank, this far. And it's trying to cut off these communities from the West Bank. And it cuts directly through several villages in the Jerusalem area. And it's doing this so that it can exclude as many people as possible. Because if you have... this gets a little bit complicated. But there are two ID systems. So there's a West Bank ID and there's a Jerusalem ID.
There's a West Bank ID and there's a Jerusalem ID.
And if you have a Jerusalem ID, you can collect, you can use the Israeli healthcare systems, you can use some of their benefits. It's a big benefit because they don't have any of that in the West Bank. But if you're on the other side of the wall, then you have to have a West Bank ID. And if you're on this side, you can get a Jerusalem ID. However, if you happen to get caught on this side of the wall, and say your family's on the other side of the wall, they're going to do everything they can to try and revert you back to a West Bank ID because they want as few people on the Jerusalem ID as possible. So they're trying to get people out of East Jerusalem, which is another, obviously, big problem. And then...
What's the importance of a little blip coming out there above the Jerusalem?
Oh, sorry. Whoops. This one?
Yeah, what's
this is a it's a demilitarized zone. What's it? No man's land. And it was created. There actually are some Palestinian villages in there, and they have a very, very difficult time even getting access to water and electricity because there's no services in there. But it was created in the war, and I'm not exactly sure for what purpose. But I do know that it's considered part of Israel now. Even though it's within the green lines. Because you can see that they built the wall here, so cut it off. Because they want all this land. But you can also see that here they haven't created a wall here, because this entire purple area right here, that is a settlement. It's the largest settlement in the West Bank. It's called Maalit Adumim. And it's strategically located, as you can see, right between the two halves, separating north and south. And once the wall is completed, I think if they're planning on having it go all the way around here, you can't fire, and it, like, it's comparable to the Holden switchbacks, and, like, you get Pizza House and your driver's on there, and it's like a death trip. So, that's pretty exciting, but it takes a long time. It takes much longer than it would if you went directly. Because they have to go all through the desert, and they can't take the same roads. They can't drive on the same roads as the settlers do. Alright, so that's wall issues. And there are many other things associated with the wall. There's art all over it in many places, as you can see. This is in Bethlehem at the Aida refugee camp. And there are several refugee camps that have been well established in the Bethlehem area that we visited fairly often. Okay, so some of the things that the Israelis do with the occupation are evictions and house demolitions. And this happens mostly in East Jerusalem. This family, we visited them, and they were evicted actually a year ago, last August. I think it was at the end of July, maybe beginning of August, right around this time. Their house is across the street that the Israeli Defense Forces, the IDF, came in the middle of the night, and they said, you have to get out, get out, get out, get out. They all got out of the house, they grabbed each other and ran, and then the next day, a Jewish family moved in. And so they set up camp across the street from their house in protest, and they've been living on the street ever since in protest. So you can see this is a sign says how many days they've been there. And this is Hamdala, who is he's a Palestinian cartoon figure, created many years ago, 15 years ago or so, by an artist, who I forget his name, but I do know the artist was killed there. And it's a little boy, refugee, and he has his back to us. He always has his back to us. And he will never grow up because he will never grow up until he can go home. That's the story. And he won't show his face either. So he's a little refugee boy. And this family has been living out here because in East Jerusalem, in several areas, there are Jewish settler organizations who have papers from several, I think in the 1800s, saying that someone had bought the land. And again, under the Ottoman control. So they have papers from the Ottoman era saying that they own this land. The problem being is the Palestinians do as well. Many Palestinians have papers from the Ottomans saying, we own this land. It says right here, we own it. But Israel doesn't recognize these papers. They will recognize them from the Jewish settlers, but not from the Palestinians. So that's one case of evictions. Other cases happen when there's a situation in the City of David. There's an archaeological excavation going on. This happens often. As you can imagine, there are many archaeological excavations that happen. It's kind of an old city. They have this site, however, that's been taken over by a settler organization that has brought in archaeologists who say that we need to dig up this whole area. In order to dig it up, you have to remove the families. So they kick out the families who are living in that area, which is this particular village is called Silwan, and they remove the families, and then they dig it up, and then they say, oh, there's nothing here of importance, and then we're going to move in a Jewish family. They've also they're going to create a museum of unity on an ancient Muslim graveyard. of it is actually Palestinian, even though Palestinians want it for their capital. Okay, Tent of Nations, this is more a rural land use issue, but there is actually a Lutheran family who have a farm near, it's just south of Bethlehem, and they call it the Tent of Nations, and it's surrounded by settlements of three of the hilltops around it, and they want this land, they want it very badly. It's an Area C, so it's under Israeli control. The family has papers from the Ottoman Empire saying that they own this land. They have papers legitimizing it. But the Israeli, because of Israeli control, they said that they can't have running water, they can't have electricity, they can't have internationals there, they can't farm the land. So what this family has done is it's invited internationals to come and be a constant presence on their land. So when people come, there's always an international person there to see. And this is a very important aspect because a lot of what they do in the West Bank is illegal. A lot of what is not sanctioned by higher authorities or treaties or these kinds of things. So when you have international people who are on the ground watching, you can't do certain things. You can't be as violent. You can't. You have to have more authority than what they do have. And so that's very important for this family. And what they've done to get around the water and electricity uses is they've dug caves underground in cisterns. So they spend a lot of time digging out these caves. They live in caves under the ground because they can't, oh, they can't build structures above the ground. That's another one. They can't have structures, building things, because it'll come and demolish it. So they build these caves. This is in their chapel that they've built. And this is Dahir Nasser, and he is one of the brothers who owns the farm. And they also have installed solar electricity, so they're working on having that, and like composting toilets and this kind of thing. It's actually, it's pretty neat, but the whole situation is, the Israeli army comes and drives down their gate every once in a while. They've had issues. In June, they had a court order saying they're going to come and knock down everything on the farm. But they appealed to the court system and they had it appealed for the moment. I think they had 90 days to revoke on that. So it's constant tension. They never know what's going to happen.
What's the size of the property?
The size of the property, it's in this ancient measuring system that I can't remember. It's like dunams or something. It's pretty large. It's an entire hilltop. I think acres-wise, it would probably be 100, 200 acres, maybe. Yeah. All right, so now we're talking about settlements. And one good example of settlements is in the city of Kibron in the south. And they have an old city. And in the middle of the old city are about 400 extreme settlers. And now most settlers are not extreme. Some of them don't even know that they're living next to Palestinians. They're considered economic. It's cheaper. The government makes it cheaper to live in settlements than it does in Israel. So they come up there because they're poor, because it's easier. They have these complexes that are nice to live in. It's a good life. But they're also extreme settlers, and they are there for ideological reasons because they want to move into a house. They want to kick all the Palestinians up because it's Judea and Samaria. It's the ancient land. It's part of Israel. We're going to colonize it. And this is in Hebron, this is the case, and they've become very violent. And so I was standing down on the street when I took this picture, looking up, and they have these guard posts with private security guards. These are not government-controlled security people. They're hired by the settlers, and they all have guns. So pretty much you look up at any point, and you're going to see something like this, and they're all watching. And what they do is they come through the city, and they have tours once a week, actually, that go through the old city of these settlers. And basically, they're not as interested in coming to see the old city as they are to harass the Palestinians on the streets and close the city down. So, and also, having to do a little bit of education, students are harassed on the way to school. Sometimes they have to go a long ways. They have to walk to school past settlers and settlements. And then the settler children will come out and they'll throw rocks and they'll yell at those children and sometimes prevent them from going. If you get into the South Hebron Hills, south of Hebron, it gets worse. They'll block off the roads. Even if there's an internet international, there have been cases of international peace volunteers being beaten by the settlers as well. The settlers will come and poison their flocks, they poison the waters, they'll cut down their olive trees. It gets pretty nasty down there.
If, this is going to sound like a stupid question, but if you were saying that the Jewish, like 80% of them don't consider themselves religious.
This is a small percentage.
So it's only like the 20% who really are motivated by ancient land religion for getting their land back. The other
80%. Well, no, not even that. Like, I would say 30% would consider themselves religious, and only a smaller percent of that would be extremists. Usually they do.
Repeat the question. We didn't all hear it.
Oh, sorry.
The extremists come from a religious background. We're talking about a very small percentage of the Israeli population. I'm trying to get the point across that Israelis are not evil people because this is happening. A lot of them don't know that it's happening. And it's the truth because there's an organization called Breaking the Silence, and it's made up of former IDF soldiers who are giving tours to Israeli citizens to come to the West Bank and see what they saw during their service. The military is mandatory in Israel, so everyone serves, but not all of them serve in the West Bank or with Palestinians. So a lot of Israelis don't know that this is happening. Honestly, the majority of them, I'm sure, don't. And one of the things with Breaking the Silence is they want the citizens to know that their moral integrity as a country is being undermined by the actions of their soldiers. They don't know that. And settlers, they're kind of like a little invasive species. I kind of think of them that way. They come in and try and get as much land, and they're quite successful. Refugees and water. So in the Shaw Piedmont Hills, when a settlement encroach too much on a village, they have to move away because to escape the violence, and so they become refugees again within their own country. And so this is a village in the South Hebron Hills that they're living in these tents, and they have very little access to water and resources. Should talk about water a little bit. Water is a scarce resource. We're in the middle of the desert out there, so I think. Let me think. The water in the West Bank is controlled, about 80% of it is controlled by Israel. Another 80%, another 75% is given to the settlers. And the other percentage is given to Palestinians who actually live there. And so that means about 70% of the water is going to 350,000 people, where over 1 million people, 1.2 or 5 million, I think, is going to the other 25%. Which means that the Palestinians live on less water a day than is guidelined by the United Nations for the amount that a person should have per day. And in the South Hebron Hills, it becomes more of a problem because there are no wells, and so they have to get their water brought in. And if they can't get the water brought in, then they can't live there. And what happens is the settlers will often attack the water sources. They'll shoot bullet holes in their water tanks and contaminate the waters with dead animals or other kinds of things to ruin their water sources. And it's another method of getting people out. And also, when the settlements were built, they were built on the best water sources and the best well. It was very strategic. They knew where the water was, they were going to control it. Which is also why Israel wanted the Golan Heights so much, is because that's where most of the rain falls, and so that's where the watershed is. So they can control how much water comes into the Jordan and flows down into the water wells. Alright, so access. This is a story. This is when I first got there, we went on this tour. An Israeli organization called the Israeli Committee Against House Demolitions, and we were going to visit this Bedouin family in East Jerusalem village that the wall is separated. So there's a gate in the wall here, you can see it, and the kids standing by it, and we were on this side, they were on the other side, we were going others or an Israeli organization. And so it's not something that is condoned, obviously legally, with an international system. So these people are being denied their services within the Israeli system.
Is that the wall in the background behind you?
Yeah. See, the wall comes around like this. And so this gate is actually just in the wall. So the wall is like right here and right here. And it's just a vehicle gate. So education, I'll talk about this a little bit, but the access to education in the South is difficult because of the harassment by the settlers. However, Palestinians are among the best educated in the Middle East. They have about a 97% literacy rate. Most of them speak English. I think they probably have the highest percentage of English speakers. The problem being is that once you get to a certain point, you can't go any farther within the Palestinian system. They have a university. They have decent universities in Bethlehem and Ramallah. They have Beirut University. But once you have your higher degree, there's no professional development within the West Bank. You have to go abroad. Many of them go abroad to get their master's and PhDs, but then they come back and they can't get a job. So you see people with a master's thesis in engineering and they're driving the bus, you know? So a lot of them want to leave. If once they get to that point, they're going to leave. They're not going to come back because they can find employment elsewhere. They can find a better life elsewhere. It's not something that they want. They want to be there. They want to be in class and live with their families. But there's nothing to come back to, really, in terms of just finding a place for your family to stay. All right. So Palestinian drones. I'm not going to say that the Israelis are perpetuating everything. Palestinians have resorted to violence in the past. They still do, especially with Hamas. And the suicide, this picture was taken in Nablus, which is where most of the suicide bombers have come from in the past. It's a city that is highly persecuted by settlers and by the Israelis it's focused on. They've had a lot of deaths. Just a couple months ago, they had a couple farmers who were shot just because they were walking in the wrong spot in their fields. They died. And the Israeli government said, oh, well, we were using rubber bullets. That, you know, rubber bullets are just bolts with rubber on the outside. They're still going to kill you. So I mean, these signs, these martyr signs, they're all over the city. And like in Gaza, there's a good documentary film called Death in Gaza. It talks about these kids who their only goal is to grow up and become martyrs. That's what they want to do. I'm not saying you can condone this kind of violence, but you can understand where it comes from. Their lives suck. I mean, it's not, they don't have any future. They don't have any kind of something to grow up to look forward to, really. And they've seen their uncles and their parents, and they've been in jail. Their dad's been in jail for the last 15 years. And incidentally, 40% of the population in Palestinians have been in jail at some point by Israeli jails. And they've seen their mother being shot. It happens in Nablus. It happens quite a lot. So they've seen all this violence in their lives, and this is something that they resort to sometimes. And one of the things that disturbed me quite a lot was the amount of toy guns that are around. I mean, the kids, that's like their favorite toy. They run around with these little tiny, you know, like machine guns, and it's scary to see, because you see these kids that are like 5 and 6 years old running around shooting each other. It's like, this is what they're doing when they're playing. This is what they're going to grow up and think is normal. So I didn't have a lot of interaction with Jews and Israelis in general. However, one incident, we did go to a Seder meal with a family that we met up in the coast, and it was a wonderful experience. I met many wonderful Israelis. And this particular part of the meal, we took wine and you put it on your plate, one vat for each of the sufferings in the world. And so we would list off, you know, famine and plague and all these kinds of things. And they were kind of a liberal family, so we do, you know, like occupation and gender injustice and all these other kinds of things. But there is a large movement within Israel for peace and justice. And it's not to be, I mean, it's significant. I wish it were more widespread. VIs that we call them. And it's a 3-month volunteer status. People come there and they volunteer their time. And what they do is they accompany Palestinians at the checkpoints. They accompany children on the way to school. A lot of them work in Hebron and the South Hebron Hills, in Bethlehem and Jerusalem. They observe the checkpoints. If there are international people observing the checkpoints, there's less likely to have violence happening there. It's been proven through statistics and that kind of thing. They keep track of the statistics of how many people got through that day, how many people were denied, how many school children were served, how many people were late, that kind of thing. They create records, and that's kind of that's important work. And there's also the Christian Peacemaker teams, which work internationally, and they are very important. They work in 3-month terms. They have 3 months on, 1 month off, 3 months on, 1 month off. It's very difficult work. They do similar things as EEPPI, but they are more involved. If there's a conflict, they can go in and they can say, what are you doing? Why are you doing this? This is illegal. You can't take this person. It's a very important, you can get updates from them online. It will outline what they've been doing for the month. And it's interesting. And these pictures were taken when a group of ELCA bishops were there last January. I think most of them have actually been now. This is praying at the wall, and then they planted olive trees, which is another big part of the international presence. People come to plant olive trees or to pick the olive harvest in the fall. And olives are an important part of the Palestinian economy. They create olive oil, they create soap, they sell to tourism, they sell it abroad. It's a large part of their heritage and their economy. But because of settler violence and because of restriction of access to their fields, they often have a hard time accessing this for planting and for harvesting. But when internationals come and help, they can often gain the access and they are less harassed. So it's an important part of the ministry is to come during those seasons and help them with that. This is a project that I worked on. This is a kid at my school. We actually weren't working with these young students, but he was watching our table and it was fantastic. So it was all right. But a group of students at the school, they wanted to write a book to President Obama and saying that we're a new generation of Palestinians and we want peace in our time. We want to be able to live our lives normally and freely like anybody else. And so it was a little bit in response to Obama's speech in Cairo, which is a while ago now. But they're basically saying, we don't want segregation law. We don't want racism in our society. We want to live normally. And so we've been working on that, going to different schools and gaining their support. So we go to a girls' school and we'll give presentations to the class, and then they'll sign a little thing saying we support this message. And we got several thousand support signatures. We're just waiting to put the book together and that kind of thing. I call it the Obama Book Project. I think that's what it's. I don't know what the official title is, but it was an exciting project to work on because the students at the Lutheran schools, they're very focused and energetic. And it was fun to work with them on this project.
Will this book get to Obama?
I hope so. We're still looking for anyone who knows him. We're thinking maybe this Christmas will, Christmas gift in Bethlehem, maybe kind of thing. But we're working maybe some steps with some senators to see if we can figure out a way to get at least close to Obama. Biden's wife visited the Lutheran Federation, World Federation premises when they were visiting this last year, so hopefully we can get a connection through that. That was a good connection. And Kairos Palestine is a new document that happened this last year. I don't know if anyone's heard of Kairos that happened in South Africa. It's the same idea. The Christian churches have come together and they've written this document. I actually have it right here. It's called The Moment of Truth, a word of faith, hope, and love from the heart of Palestinian suffering. And essentially, it's giving us a whole document on saying, we think the occupation is a sin, and it should end. And it gives an idea that we want two-state solution. They give a whole outline for what they want to have happen. And essentially saying, we want peace, we want to work this out, this is our statement. And they've been trying to gather support for this. And this is at the opening ceremony of that. This is Mitri Rahab, who is the pastor at the Christmas Lutheran Church in Bethlehem. something out of nothing. He has created this entire establishment. They have a youth program, they have a community college, they have schools, they have a foundation for cultural and arts, Palestinian culture and arts, a theater program. It's really a community center, and he's the one that has done that, and it's been amazing. And I don't know, these are representatives from all over the world. People came from churches in Africa and Asia, and I think there was Norwegians and Swedes and then Nordic churches came to support this document. So I recommend going online and looking at it. You can check it out here. It's also Kairos. You can just Google search Kairos Palestine. I think you can sign it as well. These are just pictures from my school throughout the year. So this is our scout group that's playing. I was working at the Lutheran school in Betzahor, so just kind of doing random stuff. This is our scout group. This is our choir singing at Christmas. These are some of my third graders. This is that they did a Reformation Day play. This is Martin Luther. I taught a ceramics class at the college in Bethlehem. This is one of my students' final exam pieces. He was pretty excited. And then here we have Dubka dancing, and I have a little video. I hope it works. And it's the Palestinian cultural dance. Every school has their Dubka team. And so, like, it's really actually pretty popular. I think in America it would be like, what are you doing? Kind of, you know, no one would want to do folk dancing as their main school sport. But this is the kindergarten graduation, so they start earlier. It's kind of funny, they're just hopping around. That's good. So let me see if I can figure out how to make that play.
While you're looking, did that school get mortar damaged?
No, not the school. Betzahor was a leader in the nonviolent resistance during the Second Intifada, which happened in the early 2000s. And there's a settlement that's across from it, Harhoma. And a lot of damage was done on the houses that were closest to that one because they would shoot from across the valley. But the school was on the other side of the city, so it was all right. Yeah.
When the international visitors come to observe, are they able to take pictures and video?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's an important part of the situation. Actually, there's an Israeli organization called B'Tselem that gives video tapes and cameras to Palestinians so they can record these incidents, and so they can include them in the trials and the kind of thing that they support.
Question. How do you think the Israelis would rebut some of what you just presented? Would they say they're very much threatened themselves and they have no choice?
Yeah, I mean, I think they're kind of a circle. I mean, the Israelis are saying they need to do this all because of security. And the Palestinians are saying, and the occupation is killing us. But we need to do the occupation because of security, but the occupation is killing us. It's kind of like this never-ending back and forth. And it's hard to get them to come together and talk. I mean, a lot of programs have been successful at this, but I was talking to some of my students, and they're like, you know, they were asked, do you know any Israelis? No, we don't know any Israelis. Do you want to know any Israelis? No, we don't want to know. Because they only see them at the checkpoints. Before they're 16 years old, they can cross checkpoints freely with their birth certificate. But once they're 16, they get fingerprinted, they get their magnetic ID cards, and they have to get a permit in order to pass any border crossings. They only see the soldiers. That's all they know.
Is there internet access so that people with cell phones, for instance, who are observing the checkpoints and stuff, could actually be monitoring it in a way that is in real time?
Live? Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of, if you go on YouTube, there's a lot of videos that show incidents. And a lot of the problem being is a lot of times if you have a video camera or you have a cell phone or anything, that's the first sign that the soldiers are going to go after. They're like, no, you can't film here, you can't film here. But, you know, they have a right to film. So that's what the CPTers and the EPI people are doing. And they're saying, no, we have a right. But sometimes it gets especially violent, they'll
for instance, are Christian Palestinians treated, do they work with other Muslim Palestinians side by side? Is there racism there?
Kind of. There are certain situations where that works fairly well. I mean, the college at the Lutheran Business Center is mostly Muslim students, just because there are so few Christians. But the communities, they live together, but they don't always work along that well together. I met many Christians who said, you know, we don't like the Muslims. They force everyone else to, you know, they have their calls to prayer, and everyone's forced to do what they want to do. Our women can't walk around the streets, because even the Palestinian women get harassed by the Muslim men because they're not covered. And so I wouldn't say it was complete harmony, but they live together fairly well. Like, they said, oh, the Muslims who have been here for a long time, that's okay, but the new ones that come in, because there's people coming all the time, they're crazy, you know. So it's not completely peaceful, but they do live together.
Could you comment on the more future of the situation, particularly in regards to natural resources and demographics? You see it getting worse and worse. I mean, I've read that Gaza's at the highest birth rate in the world, this little tiny, tiny piece of land.
Yeah.
It's like a bomb ready to explode sometime.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think anyone really
In fact,
knows.
I was over there, well, 30 years ago, I guess, on a business trip to Israel, and I went down to the Dead Sea, and at that time, there were two Dead Seas.
Mm-hmm.
They'd taken so much water out of the Jordan, it can't replenish the Dead Sea, so they dug a canal between the two parts. Seen that?
It's still going on. The Dead Sea goes down considerably, like 20 feet every year or something. It's pretty severe. I mean, there are resorts that used to be on the edge of the Dead Sea. There are now, you know, 300 feet inland. It's gone down a lot, and that's not the only problem, because they're worried about the Sea of Galilee, actually, because they know that there's a reserve of salt at the bottom.
Oh.
And if the water level gets too low, then the salt will come up and it'll become like the Dead Sea. It'll ruin all the fresh water. So there are numerous environmental concerns. And you walk around the West Bank and you're going to think, wow, this place is a trash heap. There's trash everywhere. And it's not necessarily the fault of anybody. It's because they don't have regular trash collection. A lot of times people will light dumpsters on fire because there's nothing else. No one's come to clean it out for 3 weeks and they have to go somewhere, so they just light it on fire. And so you get all these nasty chemicals coming into the air. And the sewage disposal plants are, you know, not that great. They put a lot of chlorine in the water to keep it safe. And a lot of it's not safe to drink, so.
But the demographics seem to be, they have big families.
Yeah.
And Israelis and immigration coming in.
Yeah.
And
it's well,
like this going, is this getting tighter and tighter and tighter? And
yeah, and the main reason why they kicked out the Palestinians out of Israel in the first place is because they need to have a Jewish majority. However, the Palestinians, the Israeli Arabs who are living in Israel with Israeli citizenship are having far more children than the Israeli families are. So even without, you know, all the refugees, the Palestinian population in Israel is going to soon exceed the Jewish population. And that's a problem because there aren't enough resources for everyone, obviously. The population of Gaza is testament to that. They are horrible situation. Their water system is almost non-existent. Their reserves are very low. And their sewage goes straight into the ocean, so they're contaminating their entire fishing supply and all their water. So,
do you have any idea if the Jewish people that are working for peace in different organizations, do they experience any subtle harassment or any?
Oh, yeah.
Like
there's an organization called Women in Black that they protest in the same week, the same corner every week. And I went there one time, and people would drive by and yell insults. They would come by and they would, you know, they would spit on these old, ancient ladies. It was like this 90-year-old woman out there protesting, and like this young kid came by and just spit on her. And I was just incensed. I was like, how can you do that? For one thing, it doesn't matter what she's thinking. You know, it says respect your elders. But like, they don't care. Many people came by and yelled. So yeah, there is a large contingent of that. I think you would find less in Tel Aviv. Tel Aviv is more secular. There's maybe more objectivity. I'm not sure about that, but it's more separated from the issue. In Jerusalem, you're going to find more conservative. It's much more conservative.
I went to Israel and the West Bank on a study tour from Augsburg College, and I'm so sad to hear that the situation is not better but is worse than it was 20 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
I have vivid memories of things that I saw. One in particular was this water issue. We visited a Palestinian town in the West Bank, and I don't remember exactly where it is. The houses were built of stone, and they, I don't remember what kind of roofs they had, but they were very poor looking. There was no running water. Water was available down at the bottom of their hill. And we stood in this village and looked at the opposite hill, and here was an Israeli settlement. The buildings were new, they were several stories tall, they were white, and around them was the most beautiful green grass you can imagine, and we saw sprinklers watering the grass, and we couldn't believe it. And it sounds to me like those things have not changed.
Nope, it's the same.
That they're perhaps worse than ever.
Yeah, all their lives going into the lawns and gardens and the swimming pools and settlements. I don't see, I mean, people come back and it's constantly changing. People come back and they say, wow, it's different. Even a couple months go by and you come back and you're like, wow, this checkpoint's closed now. You know, like, it can't go through there. Even, you know, a week or two, and it's different. And you talk to Palestinian people, international people who've been there for years and years, and they say, you know, it's not getting better. It's getting worse. And so it's hard to see any kind of solution. It really is.
That's the bottom line.
One thing that you have said, though, that there's a lot more involvement of the Christian churches in these issues. International involvement, which I don't remember seeing much of. So a lot of what's happening is coming more to light than I think it did in the past. Certainly my trip was very eye-opening. I had no idea those things were going on because they're not reported in the press.
Yeah, and you're very lucky to have a group that sees that. Most tour groups do not see any of this. It's specifically designed so they do not, most tourists do not see Palestinians. The checkpoint going into Bethlehem is very controlled so that the tourists see very minimal amount of security. They see only the sites that the Israeli guides want them to see. And they're in and out in a day. And there are a few organizations that will, you know, visit refugee camps, visit Palestinians, visit the schools, visit the churches, and meet the people. And when you leave at the airport, you know, they ask you, you know, where you've been, you've been living and working in Jerusalem. Whole other issue. I didn't actually officially live in Beit Sahor. I was not allowed to. But you always say that, and have you interacted with any locals? Have you met any locals? And you know that if you answer that question honestly and say, yes, I've been working with Palestinians all year, they're going to be there for about 5 hours being questioned. And it happens often.
Would you characterize the Israeli government's attitude and the way they treat Palestinians as terrorism?
In certain acts, yes. I would say I would call it more sinister.
More sinister than terrorism.
Yeah. I mean, there are acts of the settlers I would call terrorism. The scary part of the government is that you can see that there's motives. They have a plan. They have a plan for how they want this to go. And they're slowly, through various methods, bringing the borders in, increasing the occupation, decreasing international involvement and that kind of thing. So
would it also be safe to say that the U.S. is United States government, ergo our support of the United States government, policies in support of Israel?
And so for anything to get done on a congressional level would be virtually impossible because the Jewish lobby got half of the people elected. So it's very, it gets complicated on that level. And the thing is that people, the Jewish lobbies are also being supported by Jewish people who are also supporting settlements. And so it's this big web of collusion that happens between the two. And it's hard to unwind, it's hard to figure out. There is a, J Street is an organization in the U.S. that works with Jewish organizations to not support settlements and to help educate Jewish leaders and communities within the U.S. about situations and how they can help reduce the impact of occupation. So there are organizations in the U.S. working as well.
Is Hamas still adamant about destroying Israel someday?
Yeah, I think reality is going to catch up to them sometime.
Yeah, it's just hard to work with somebody that says, I'm going to kill you. Too
yeah.
Early, I'm going to kill you.
Yeah.
What do you say? I mean, how do you
Well, they're losing